This episode of CPR's Connect the Dots is brought to you by the Center for Progressive Reform. Our podcast is supported in part by the College of Law and the College of Music and Media at Loyola University, New Orleans. Imagine a world where an afternoon thunderstorm floods your basement with sewage and industrial pollutants. Soon you're dreading the rain. Summer spaces that used to be dedicated to water balloon fights and bike rides, they become venues for wildfires and hurricanes instead. A hard day's work leads to an even harder battle with disease and stroke. It all might sound like a nightmare, but then again, it doesn't compare to the situation your family previously faced, starving and fending off violence when your livelihood was destroyed by drought. Now, these are just some of the realities encountered by climate change migrants around the country. The planet, we know, it's getting hotter, drier, wetter, and weirder, and marginalized groups of many types are in the bullseye. Some experts today estimate that nearly a billion people will flee their homes in the next 30 years because of environmental and economic factors that are amplified by climate disruption. For these migrants, it's a matter of life or death. Many of them have moved only to find their situations barely improved. Job opportunities are limited, affordable housing poses health threats, and government benefits aren't included. And of course, there's even a bigger issue. Where do you go to hide from a crisis that's threatening the entire planet?
We're talking about many millions of people. We could be talking about many more as we understand better how heat extremes will really affect the tropical and subtropical zones of our planet, rendering those places uninhabitable, such that we could be talking about a third of the human population.
Immigrants coming in, they have very limited options in where they can move because rent is so high. So they have to move to these already vulnerable communities. I mean, you need an ID to get food at a food bank here. If you can't even get food, how are you going to seek shelter from a storm or from a heat wave?
Even if we've managed to figure out how to make fossil fuels more viable, there's still going to be losses in these communities. And if there's no economic diversity, it's going to be enormously painful and much more painful than it need be.
You're listening to CPR's Connect the Dots, a podcast produced by the Center for Progressive Reform. This season, season four, we're examining the impact of climate disruption across the globe and how it's affecting you. I'm your host, Rob Virchik. On today's episode, what some are calling the Great Climate Migration. We examine a world pushed into motion and the challenges millions of people are tackling as they set out to escape unprecedented forces of nature. A lot of it juiced up by us. Now, on the last episode of Connect the Dots, we looked at how discriminatory practices and ideology contribute to the mounting threat that climate disruption poses for vulnerable communities. There's no denying that some areas of our country and world are more susceptible to the impacts of extreme weather and other impacts of climate disruption. What we're also seeing, however, is that many of these populations can't withstand the shock. Those that are able to move will, and in fact, many of them are. By some estimates, 30 million people will be migrating across the United States alone by the year 2050 just because of sea level rise. Others predict even higher figures. And for the world? Well, that number comes closer to a billion people. So why exactly are people moving? I mean, a hot day doesn't seem like enough of a push, right? There are pools when it gets hot, perhaps cooling centers in more dire circumstances. Similarly, a bad flood or a hurricane doesn't merit all-out departure from your home. Most people like to stick around and rebuild. They have a job, they've got a house, generations of family in the neighborhood. But if that neighborhood is constantly threatened by storms, you can't keep rebuilding. If the heat gets bad enough, you might lose your job, your income. You won't be able to put food on the table. If the tides are slowly enveloping the land, your choice is going to be to leave or to drown. Some research suggests that by 2070, 1 in 3 people on the planet will live in a place that's no longer hospitable. You may remember Maxine Burkett from our previous episode. She's one of CPR's member scholars and also a professor of law at the University of Hawaii. Maxine's parents were immigrants from Jamaica. Maxine has been studying climate migration for years, and her studies show similar outcomes.
We've seen numbers as small, relatively speaking, as 25 million to as large as 1 to 2 billion people sort of being shuffled around the globe. And it's really hard to imagine or plan around that range. 250 million has often been offered as a possible number. It's unclear how defensible that is, not because the phenomenon won't happen and it won't be large, but really being able to hone in on the exact number and exact time is difficult.
The urgency, nevertheless, is clear. Where Maxine lives in Hawaii, in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, the sea level is rising at a rate of about 12 millimeters per year. Now, that's not even a half an inch, but already 8 islands in the Western Pacific have sunk. By 2100, scientists predict we'll lose 40 more islands in the Pacific.
What we're seeing is undeniable. I'm in Honolulu, and I've been jaw-dropped because during the months of June and July, Siberia's temperature consistently higher than Hawaii. It was hitting 100 degrees on certain days. And that heat wave, which has had knock-on wildfires and oil spills because of melting permafrost, this data show that it was 600 times more likely because of climate change.
Folks at the World Bank estimate that in 2017, 68.5 million people will be involuntarily displaced, more than at any point in human history. Now, a third of these populations were forced to move because of a sudden onset weather event, something like flooding, a wildfire, or intensified storms. The rest are due to crises that were furthered by climate-related impacts, like desertification, sea level rise, air pollution, the loss of biodiversity, things that can lead to famine, social turmoil, and, of course, financial ruin. These slow-onset events are equally destructive. Because climate change casts a wide net, the number of people affected is almost inconceivable. It may not be the sole factor prompting migration, but it is undoubtedly a catalyst. Now, nearly half of all Americans will experience a decline in the quality of their environment over the next 50 years, especially more heat and less water. Similarly, a study conducted by the New York Times found that if carbon emissions rise at extreme levels, at least 4 million Americans could find themselves living in a place outside of what is recommended to support human life. That's in America. Southern regions are already succumbing to such fates.
It's oddly dystopian. It's affecting our conversations about issues like immigration and equity and xenophobia. We are seeing heat extremes and drought and collapsing agriculture in parts of Central America that is a factor, if not a significant factor, in the northward migration of people from South Central America. We're having a profoundly contentious conversation about our policy along the U.S.-Mexico border, and we are not talking about the fact that so much of what is happening is being fueled, at least in part, by the impacts of climate change.
Now, I know that I've been throwing around a lot of numbers, so let's take a look at how this plays out on the ground in a particular place. Let's take Guatemala, for example. The country saw little rain for almost 5 years, rendering arable land nearly worthless. When the storms finally came, there was severe flooding, farmers lost what few crops that they had been able to cultivate, and that flooding was followed by more instances of drought, and many farmers, some of whom had taken out loans to cover previous losses, went bankrupt. In 2012, a coffee blight worsened by climate change cut harvests in El Salvador by 70%, and extreme tropical storms further destroyed livelihoods. Families had to move to find new sources of income, and conflicts arose. As gangs routinely prey on the vulnerable, these new residents are seen as intruders, leading to increases in murder, robbery, and rape. Now, in places like Guatemala and El Salvador, as you can imagine, getting adequate insurance to cover crop loss or flooding, I mean, that's incredibly difficult, right? And in the United States, it's also really hard. Think about the Tubbs wildfire that hit Santa Rosa, California in 2017. That fire destroyed 1,800 buildings, more than 90% of all the infrastructure there, and insurance brokers started to rethink their contingency plans and whether or not they actually needed to raise rates. All told, what once would have been bad, climate change has made nearly unbearable.
There are a number of drivers for migration. It could be political. It could be the state of the country that you are seeking to leave. The key for me is that if we understand that climate change is a present threat, we can see climate change as a greater fingerprint. The typical kinds of decision-making processes are absolutely going to be affected by this new driver that is, in some cases, making it impossible for you to contemplate staying.
Well, it seems apparent why people are moving, and many have an argument for doing that. But where are these millions and millions of people going to go? Most climate migrants move within their own countries. But if you look at the United States, for example, there just aren't that many areas that are exempt from tumultuous weather patterns. Let me give you an illustration. I teach every year a course called Disaster Law and Policy. And as an icebreaker to the course when my students all arrive, we play a game that I call Escape from Climate Change. Now, here's how it works. I say, the seas are swelling, the temperatures are rising. That's bad news for warm cities on the coast like Los Angeles, Miami, Norfolk. We know it's bad news for New Orleans, where I live and teach. You can't always depend, maybe, on levees and other things. So imagine that you've lost your faith in the city's infrastructure and you want to escape. Where are you going to go? Well, there's always a student who says Seattle. Right? It's rainy, it's gray now, but hey, in the future, we'll be growing oranges. Sorry, I say, Western Washington is losing its snowpack to warmer weather, and the local counties are panicked about water shortages right now. The coastal rainforests have seen hotter and hotter and deadlier wildfires as plant and soil moisture dissipates. And I haven't even mentioned that the region is also overdue for a massive earthquake and tsunami. Rapid City, says somebody else, South Dakota. It's far inland, it's close to the Sturgis motorcycle rally. What could go wrong? I mean, besides COVID. But as in the Northwest, South Dakota's Black Hill Forest, they're losing moisture too. And in the area around Rapid City, the risk of wildfire is expected to climb about 600% in the next 50 years. And so you're going to need more than a biker's bandana to keep the smoke out of your lungs with that. So then somebody says, oh, Alaska. Sorry. The permafrost is melting and more than a dozen coastal villages are sliding toward the sea. And as the frozen soils melt, scientists expect a release of millions of ancient bacteria and viruses to which humans have lost immunity. You can see why I don't get invited to many going away parties. Anyway, experts are saying that because of sea level rise alone, at least about 13 million Americans are going to be forced to move away from submerged coastlines. And there's almost nowhere to run. I mean, we can't all fit into Kansas City, Missouri. Actually, I used to live there and my house flooded. Here's more from Maxine Burkett.
We're talking about many millions of people. We could be talking about many more as we understand better how heat extremes will really affect the tropical and subtropical zones of our planet, rendering those places uninhabitable, such that we could be talking about a third of the human population. The challenge is profoundly unique. Humans have been on the move since we were upright, but we usually are going to other places to have better livelihoods. But in this scenario, we're going from sensitive places to places that are also sensitive.
For those crossing international borders, the problem just gets worse, compounded by immigration hazards and inadequate resources. More than 30 million migrants are expected to approach the U.S. border over the next 30 years on account of climate-induced flight. Particularly in Central America, people are running short of food because of persistent drought, fluctuating temperatures, unpredictable rainfall. All of those things have reduced crop yields. Now, these are countries that depend on farming for business and for livelihood. They've got no choice but to head north. As Maxine explains, migrants may have contemplated moving for any number of reasons, but climate change sealed the deal.
Climate refugees, and more informally, is a way of understanding how climate impacts are spurring movements that might not otherwise have happened absent the change in climate, right? Absent the impacts of floods and fires and increasing drought and sea level rise and things like that. When we think about refugees, there's oftentimes usually we're describing cross-border migration. And really what we're seeing is that climate migration is a way of understanding how climate change will alter sort of existing interconnections and human mobility patterns.
While prevailing misconceptions lead us to believe immigrants come to the United States as their first choice, a lot of people would prefer to stay where they are or at least return once they find their footing. Gina Ramirez is a third-generation Mexican-American. Now based in Chicago, Gina explained to me her conflicting interests.
I have a lot of in-laws that still live in Mexico, and they're really concerned about losing their land and job opportunities, and they have no choice but to leave. It's such a beautiful part of Mexico, Michoacán, and people just have so much pride about it. I do as well, and I wish, you know, I could live there because it definitely beats the scenery that I look at now facing all of the industry.
Gina's great-grandfather came to the United States in 1930, seeking work with U.S. Steel, and her family has remained there ever since. Her grandfather served in the Korean War and went on to work in the steel mills, as did her father. Three generations employed in factories and calling the south side of Chicago home. It's a legacy Gina takes pride in, but also struggles with.
There's a lot of bodegas, street vendors. We have one of the oldest Mexican parishes called Our Lady of Guadalupe. We had like the most Mexican Vietnam vets within the United States. And so there's this really cool mural. It has the faces of the fallen soldiers from that war. And we have every Memorial Day have this beautiful remembrance for them. And I love that. People really aren't forgotten. I'm the third generation resident and I still haven't left is really saying something. And it's pretty much the norm.
On the other hand, what's passed on from generation to generation isn't always ideal.
My grandfather was asthmatic and had diabetes. And my dad has diabetes and a bunch of autoimmune issues. And that's the norm that goes on in this neighborhood. We've lost countless relatives to cancer. My mother's asthmatic. It's like certain diseases, like very specific diagnosis that people get in this neighborhood that I don't think is a coincidence. I think it is related to the industry that people were working in, the legacy of pollution that still remains. It's unfortunate. My mother told me she grew up right by U.S. Steel. Every morning, she would wake up and there would be red soot on the ground and on her father's car, and she would play in it. You know, other relatives said that they would not dry their clothes out for very long on the laundry line because they would be covered in black soot.
These days, Gina doesn't deal with soot on her clothing, but she routinely confronts other hurdles attributable to climate change, extreme heat, and flooding, because as I mentioned, almost no place is safe from the crisis at hand.
Flooding is definitely an issue that is a huge concern in our neighborhood. We had a huge rainstorm this past May, and so many people within our community reached out and said that they had sewer water in their basement, and there's nothing that they could do about it. Our streets are constantly flooded. We share the same sewer system as the industry in my neighborhood. So if we have, you know, huge storm and we're getting sewer back up in our basement, there is a slight possibility that there is also toxic contaminants in that water. I'm worried about the stormwater runoff as well because we're in such close proximity to industry. You know, if General Iron's moving to the neighborhood and they're shredding cars completely as is, that also is going into our sewer system. And if I have a backup, I mean, I could have all sorts of crazy things in my basement.
Chicago is not the only major city tackling uncontrollable water. In some neighborhoods in Miami, streets flood daily with the tides, even when the sun is out. Along with the water comes sewage. Residents are forced to trek through unsanitary overflow just to catch the bus. Florida officials have acknowledged the situation, but they say that defending some roadways is just unaffordable. And as usual, insurance companies find loopholes to avoid payouts. Yeah, and there's also the heat. The heat strikes again, even in a city like Chicago, notorious for its cold and windy winters.
I feel like my first introduction into like sociology and environmentalism was the 1995 Chicago heat wave, where 739 people perished. And I remember watching the news and just seeing like the death toll rising every day. And it was in predominantly African-American and Latino communities that this was happening. And I was like, this is because people don't have money for air conditioning. We didn't have air conditioning. You know, I grew up, you know, pretty poor. And I remember my parents just trying to keep us alive that summer. They would scrape up enough money to drop us off at the mall because there weren't cooling centers yet established in Chicago. Now there are because so many people had died. But my parents, you know, they had to drive us to a suburb, leave us there all day so we could be in air conditioning. And then while they were at work, and then at night, we would take turns driving around in our air conditioned car. No one on my block had air conditioning. We would all be kind of like sitting outside of our house at night. And that still happens today in my neighborhood. My neighbors across the street, they are out all night because they are overheated.
The journey of the climate migrant rarely ceases. With little choice but to move and few places to go once relocated, peril often follows. And this is especially true in poor countries. Think about it from a practical perspective. You've lost your land due to flooding or drought. You probably are going to go to a city, an urban area where commerce and industry isn't so susceptible to weather conditions. So there you're going to have higher populations of people clustering in an area. You're going to be stretching the infrastructure and the resources in that place. There's not enough housing to accommodate everyone, not enough food. Informal settlements are going to pop up and spread, sometimes called slums. Conditions are going to deteriorate. And of course, all of this is going to lead to other kinds of disruption, extremism, gangs, violence. For this reason, many international refugees seek asylum in the United States, acquiescing to whatever that might entail. As Maxine Burkett observes, the benefits appear to outweigh the costs.
The discussion on immigration has been marked by demagoguery and xenophobia and a lot of misinformation. There are conditions in Central America that are really rendering it impossible to have a sound livelihood in those, in places like Honduras and Guatemala and El Salvador. And that is inspiring northward migration, even for a migrant who understands just how dangerous it is. So if we were to step back and understand, fully aware of the villainizing of, say, the migrant caravan and the stories around what has happened with respect to ICE and, you know, taking children and literally putting them in cages. If you understand that that's a possibility and yet you still make the decision that it's better than staying where you are, we have a clear instance of just how grave the scenarios are. It's been at least 10 years that we've understood that there is a relationship between the number of people who are seeking to cross the border and the collapse of agriculture. If we could have a conversation about climate change, period. if we could have a conversation about how our activities, our consumption, our extraction here is compromising livelihoods in the places where people, again, for the most part, would like to stay. If we could talk with a lens of care about what it means to have to take that journey, which itself is dangerous, and come to the United States and be labeled criminal, then we would have, I think, very different policies.
Understand, it's difficult to establish asylum in the United States, period, but especially where harms are related to climate change. Though the climate crisis amplifies threats like gang activity, domestic violence, and poverty, it doesn't make for a good case at the border. Agents demand evidence of a well-founded fear of persecution on account of race, religion, nationality, membership in a particular social group, or a political opinion. The potential harm has to be severe and imminent. Now, if you can't provide that, they send you back. This is a standard that made sense after World War II, when the standards for asylum were being developed and people were concerned about eruptions of military violence. But today's climate crisis is slow moving, and that's a problem.
because of the requirements of urgency, some kind of status that is a special sort of class of race, gender, political orientation, for example, if you are part of that, if you are concerned about persecution and that concern is urgent, then you have a claim to move across the border and seek that refuge from a host country. If we take the definition as it stands, the circumstances of climate change oftentimes don't meet that. There are some instances where you can imagine that climate has created a political situation that has put you at greater risk of harm, but that's not the sort of the causal pathway that we see most often in terms of climate change.
Making it into the country with or without documents is the first challenge. But then these refugees have to find housing and work, pay taxes, support their families. They may or may not be able to manage instances of flooding, like Gina mentioned, or buy air conditioners to balance the heat. Worse, the Trump administration has notably targeted immigrants during its 4 years in power, with little interest in understanding the complexities of such migrant narratives. In Gina's community, raids by ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, seriously thwart efforts to improve her neighborhood.
We had some ICE raids in my neighborhood. One of our pizza parlors, actually the owner and a few of its workers were taken away. And we had a GoFundMe to try to bail them out and get them the legal care that they needed. Luckily, they're back in operation, but that really scared the community. Simultaneously, at that same time, we were trying to get volunteers for our health study, and we had to do some door knocking. A lot of the immigrant community was terrified. They don't feel comfortable sharing any sort of information. They're afraid that, you know, they might get deported if they partake in a health study, or they don't even want to report a foul odor or report seeing something, you know, like a dust being emitted from a truck. They feel like they can't even talk about the injustices that they're facing.
These injustices that Gina refers to include things like pollution from nearby factories, a lack of green space, inequitable housing. All of these issues, you might remember, were raised by activist Michael Johnson from the South Bronx, whom I spoke with in a previous episode.
Immigrants coming in, they have very limited options and where they can move because, you know, rent is so high. So they have to move to these already vulnerable communities. And these communities have already been exposed to hazardous conditions. And they're the ones who aren't getting, you know, the new latest and greatest green initiatives and trails and parks. They're the ones living next to the Superfund sites and the toxic legacy. In my neighborhood, we're being pushed out constantly by polluters. We're under-resourced, we're under-invested, and we're over-policed. The land use and zoning policies are completely broken in Chicago. And the north side of Chicago is predominantly white and wealthy. And they're getting a lot of amenities and infrastructure improvements as they're getting the 606 Trail, which is this beautiful, you know, green infrastructure trail. They want to push out some of the old industry that exists there. So the north side will be getting a brand new park, while the southeast side, which is overburdened with pollution, we're a red zone, we have high rates of asthma and cancer, we're going to get general iron. We're essentially seen as a sacrifice zone. We're a concierge for the city's garbage, essentially.
It's sad to think about. People whose only goal really is to work hard and protect their families. Many of them can't vote or even claim services that their sales and payroll taxes support.
You need an ID to get food at a food bank here. If you can't even get food, how are you going to seek shelter from a storm or from a heat wave?
As you might expect, migrating populations create new challenges for the labor market, particularly in the types of enterprises already upended by climate change. Some immigrants only qualify for jobs in farming or manufacturing, for instance, and those two sectors are pretty vulnerable to climate impacts. Crops can flood in the rain and wither in a drought. Many factories are also threatened by storms and floods. And in times of drought, those factories can lose access to water that's used in cooling or in other manufacturing processes. If these things get bad enough, some employers will have to fold. On top of that, a lot of manufacturing depends on burning fossil fuel, which of course is causing global warming in the first place. As we move toward a greener economy, those industries will be going through big transitions, where some sectors will see lots of job growth and others will see job loss. In the end, many experts believe that net job growth will be substantial in the United States as we move to a green economy. But the worker who loses a job at the Indiana coal plant won't be the same one who gets a job installing solar panels in Albuquerque. Aaron Bernstein is the interim director of the Center for Climate, Health, and the Global Environment at Harvard University. He's also an assistant professor of pediatrics and a pediatrician. I talked to him recently about this catch-22.
We're quick to talk about the reality that many people in this country, and particularly people of color and the poor, have been harmed by decisions around energy in the past, and that we need to right those wrongs. But there is no just transition in energy when we decide as a society that we need to change how we get energy and leave behind all the folks who have been producing that energy. We're much too quickly ignoring the reality for many people in this country, which is if fossil fuels become more expensive, and we've seen this already with coal, the closure of coal is being driven by the fact it's too expensive. The reason it's too expensive is because coal has been killing people, and Congress passed the Clean Air Act to essentially put a price on pollution coming from coal. And coal plants are closing and coal mines are at risk because the demand for coal is down. These communities may not have anywhere to turn to for economic opportunity.
To be clear, Aaron is not suggesting that we shouldn't be cutting industrial pollution or that we shouldn't be moving towards cleaner energy. He's fighting for that. It's also true that the demand for coal is declining for other reasons besides pollution control, like the boom in natural gas production and changes in the global steel industry, which uses coal as a raw material in the production process. Anyway, it's irrefutable, though, that our job market will be changing a lot as we make the transition to renewable energy. And all the stakeholders involved have to be part of that discussion, including, of course, the workers.
We need to start by asking them what this looks like for them. What would they want? Many of them don't want to change. They want coal and oil and gas to be here forever, and that would be great if it weren't going to result in problems for everybody. And so to the extent that there's an open line of communication there, that people are willing to have that conversation, then we as a society need to be responsible to their welfare in particular.
Also, remember what we learned from Michael Johnson in the South Bronx. The expansion of industry doesn't necessarily translate to highly touted job growth. Gina Ramirez says the opposite happened in her Chicago community. Factories moved in, but job growth was pretty small. Conversely, environmental problems went through the roof.
The industry that is moving to my neighborhood is not creating jobs. General Iron, when I met with the owners, said that they were just moving its complete operation down. So that included their workers. And the warehouses that are starting to pop up on the south and west sides of Chicago, those are creating union jobs to build the infrastructure. They're going to be temporary, non-union, maintaining the status quo for people in the neighborhood. You know, they're going to be like minimum wage jobs. It's not something like the steel mills back in the heyday. You know, it was like a one person, one income family, and you could have two cars and, you know, help your child go to college and have a savings. That doesn't exist anymore. My great grandfather, my grandfather, and my dad worked at these mills because they didn't know the data that was out there. They didn't know that they were going to eventually have all these diseases and die prematurely from them. But now that we do know that, and we're such an innovative world, I think that we could find jobs. They're blue collar, but they won't, you know, kill us.
Aaron Bernstein agrees. Look at the way the government subsidizes oil or corn, even housing. Could we offer similar support for the labor market?
In the same way that a farmer is planting so much of what they plant today because the government is essentially paying them to do one thing versus the other. If there were a job available to them that didn't require them to do what they're doing and that paid them the same and offered them the same job security, they would probably take it. That's a challenge we need to work on, you know, because I think particularly when it comes to coal, you see these communities which have essentially been abandoned. It's like the Rust Belt all over again. Even if we've managed to figure out how to make fossil fuels more viable, there's still going to be losses in these communities. And if there's no economic diversity, it's going to be enormously painful and much more painful than it need be.
Again, we find ourselves lost in the midst of many less than ideal alternatives. Connecting the dots on this one requires us to venture back to the beginning, to the stimulus of all this migration. We need to offer people a reason not to move. Protect homes and land, support hardship that stems from our ever-evolving planet, and while we're at it, delay environmental degradation as much as we can. Now, there will always be some cases where it's just too unsafe or expensive for people to stay where they are. But I guarantee there are so many other places that just need the right preparation and investment. Studies suggest that medium-sized investments could counter many of the effects of climate change, supporting irrigation infrastructure, for example, assisting with food and livelihood security, providing safer modes of transportation, or expanding destination country integration resources. Further, the New York Times reports that if governments reduce emissions even by small margins, the number of legal immigrants from Central America and Mexico would decline, dropping from more than 1 million by 2050 to about 680,000. On the other hand, Mexican migration to the United States scales upward during periods of drought. If left unattended, by 2080, climate change could lead 6.7 million more people towards the U.S. border. Then what'll we do? Maxine Burkett says it's all about policy and leadership.
There are a number of sort of informal principles around how to manage internal displacement all the way up to a climate change refugee treaty. This sort of complexity increases manyfold based on the type of proposal that you're putting in. We don't have time for the sort of level of complexity that might take and the politics involved in it. But I do, again, struggle with the fact that in a vacuum, we are really just left with the rhetoric and exclusionary policies of leadership, especially in the United States and in Europe, which are oftentimes destination states for some of the cross-border migration.
There's no way around it. People are moving across the nation, across the world. Keep in mind, there's only so much space to hold us all, and it urgently needs your attention. Thanks for listening to CPR's Connect the Dots, a podcast by the Center for Progressive Reform. For more information on this episode and the stories behind it, or to find out how you can become involved in combating climate change, please visit our podcast site, www.progressivereform.org. You can also follow us on Twitter, at CPRblog, all one word, and on Instagram, Progressive Reform, all one word. And of course, please subscribe to this podcast and share it with friends. I'd like to thank our guests today, Dr. Aaron Bernstein, Maxine Burkett, and Gina Ramirez. You can learn more about them at our website, too. Thanks also to our producer, Courtney Garcia, and our assistant producer, Brian Gum. Our theme music is by Lobo Loco and Blue Dot Sessions. And I'm Rob Verchik. Until next time, be safe and take care of one another.